3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with me, Hannah, and Rob.
Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
I'm good.
That's good.
Sleepy this morning.
So sleepy.
I feel like I'm only just starting to get used to the early wake-ups of being back at work and the radio show again, you know? My body's still a little bit like, what's going on? Why are we up at 5 a.m.?
Yeah, this is the only time I wake up this early, so I don't know if I'm ever going to get used to it.
You're so brave.
Thanks.
There's a lot of rain coming today.
Oh, that's
apparently
nice.
So just beware, listeners, if you're out and about today, to
wear a rain jacket.
Wear a rain jacket, take an umbrella.
Maybe put your indoor plants outside.
Your indoor plants outside. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah. My housemate was like mowing her lawn over the weekend and like sprinkling grass seed to get it, you know, because it's all patchy.
Oh.
So she's like, yeah, I've got to do it before the rain comes.
Wow.
And then we're like, you know, like got the roller thing.
Oh.
Yeah, you know, that you fill with water and you roll it.
What? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah. So it's like to stop the grass being so patchy. There you go. Now I can actually see you.
Yes, the microphone is right in front of your face.
True.
I've never done grass seeds.
Yeah,
I'm anti-grass seed.
I don't know. Yeah, I was just
also,
like,
you know,
yeah.
Have a lawn if you want to have a lawn.
Have a lawn if you want to have a lawn, but it's not my house, so I'm just like.
Yeah, totally. I'll help you with the lawn.
Yeah, but I felt bad because she's doing all the garden work by herself, so that's just like weeding and
cute.
Whatever.
Yeah, actually, that kind of segues quite well into the second segment that we're going to play today.
Mm-hmm.
We're doing the second segment ever of this new segment we've got. If you've tuned in last month, it was wing beats per minute. I think last month it was about bees. And this month is about butterflies. And yeah, they talk about why keeping a little patch of long grass in your garden is good for butterflies to lay eggs at.
So that'll be happening at what? 7:30?
Yeah, around
7:30.
Oh, maybe
like
7:45.
Yeah. And it's as Hannah said, it's the second iteration of our regular segment called Wing Beats Per Minute here on the Monday Breakfast Show. But before that, do you want to tell us about the interview that we're going to start off with, Hannah?
Yeah, on Saturday I helped record this interview that Rosie Ganino, who I did the Earth Matters show for International Women's Day with, she interviewed Alva Geeky, who she's a 90-year-old woman, and she was like one of the first women in the NAM, Women's Lib movement, back in the 70s. And she was housemates with Zelda DiPrano, and she tells us all about all of the actions that they did back in the 70s, and she's amazing.
It's going to be so special to listen to.
It was great. I've split it into two because I just wanted listeners to be able to hear the whole thing.
Yep.
So the first half will play this week and the second half will play next week.
Cool.
And yeah, following International Women's Day last Friday, I just thought it would be a great thing to play.
International Working Women's Day too.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. And Labor Day.
Yeah.
That's so cool. And then the show is going to end with an interview that James McKenzie from the In Your Face show did with comedian Cassie Workman, about their show, which is currently on at the, well, not currently on, which will be on at the Melbourne International Comedy Fest, called You Are Here. They also speak about Cassie's experiences living as a trans person under the Trump regime. So that's happening after probably around 8 o'clock, just after 8 o'clock.
Cool.
Yeah, maybe we should also talk about our extracurricular excursion to the Australian Queer Archives. Not last week, but the week before.
Yeah.
Shout out to the folks at the Australian Queer Archives.
That was amazing. We were looking at old 3CR archives and the old lesbian and gay show here at 3CR and all of their old flyers.
The flyers were amazing.
Oh, I loved it. And the old fundraising, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, they had lots of funny prints for their radiothons and, it was, it made me actually, I feel like
I've been
feeling quite emotional about
it. The, was really special because, like, we walked in and they're like, okay, like, we're looking for sort of, like, old 3CR audio, and they're like, okay, we've got all of these things. Here's audio from 1979. Do you want to listen to it? And we're like, absolutely.
So cool.
So, yeah, super special. And if anyone is listening and wants to help or even go to the Queer Archives to just, you know, peruse their collection, they've got a lot of amazing books and little display cabinet of all of these badges from the queer activist scene. Yeah, you can email them. And you can find them at the Pride Centre in St. Kilda.
Yeah.
I keep thinking about the letter that we saw.
Of the cop?
No, not that one. The letter that someone wrote to the, I think, the Gay Liberation radio show.
Yeah, about them playing too much Madonna.
Asking them to stop paying Madonna.
So funny.
Which, in another life, that could have been us.
It could have been us. It's us with Courtney Barnett, probably.
Anyway, should we do our headlines?
Yeah, let's get into it. Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty gritty now. One.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. These are the news headlines for Monday, the 16th of March, 2026. Human rights advocates, the Human Rights Law Centre, is sounding the alarm over new migration laws that could prevent tens of thousands of people holding valid Australian visas from entering the country while fleeing conflict. Under the proposed Migration Amendment Act 2026, the Minister for Home Affairs would gain sweeping powers to block temporary visa holders from travelling to Australia, even if they already hold valid visas. The policy could immediately affect up to 61,000 people in the Middle East region, with the Department of Home Affairs confirming that around 7,200 Iranian visa holders may be among the first to have their visas cancelled or suspended. Sanmati Verma, legal director at the Human Rights Law Centre, said the laws risk abandoning families already trapped in escalating violence. Verma said, quote, "The Albanese government is not only abandoning thousands of visa holders in Iran, Lebanon and the region, but also their families, friends and communities here in Australia who are already desperately worried for their safety," end quote. The organisation argues the new powers deepen Australia's restrictive migration regime, which already includes offshore detention and boat turnbacks. Advocates say the laws could also compound uncertainty for hundreds of Iranian asylum seekers who have lived in Australia for years on precarious bridging visas after being transferred from offshore detention in Nauru and Papua New Guinea. Verma said, quote, "We cannot allow our government to pick and choose who is worthy of safety based on photo opportunities and political alliances. Hundreds of people from Iran who sought asylum in Australia over a decade ago are now part of the fabric of our communities, yet still live with constant uncertainty on month-to-month visas. They must finally be afforded permanent safety," end quote. Rights groups say the debate now raises a broader question about Australia's humanitarian responsibilities during global conflicts and whether those already promised safety will be allowed to reach it.
Also in news this week, leading health experts are urging governments to urgently rethink Australia's approach to brain health after new data confirmed dementia has become the country's leading cause of death. Writing in the Australia and New Zealand Journal of Public Health, researchers say deteriorating brain health is an escalating public health threat that has not received the policy attention it demands. Professor Tanya Buchanan, CEO of Dementia Australia, described the latest figures as a stark warning, saying, quote, "Dementia is now the leading cause of death in Australia." She also said, "Dementia is not an inevitable disease of old age. Whilst we cannot change getting older, genetics or family history, there are things we can do to reduce our risk of dementia," end quote. According to estimates cited by the authors, around 446,500 Australians are currently living with dementia, a number projected to exceed 1 million by 2065, without significant intervention. Researchers say that many people remain unaware that risk can be reduced. A 2024 survey by Dementia Australia found more than a quarter of Australians incorrectly believe nothing can be done to prevent the disease. Public health leaders argue prevention must become central to national policy. Adjunct Professor Terry Slevin, CEO of the Public Health Association of Australia, said around 2 in 5 dementia cases are linked to modifiable risk factors such as smoking, obesity, physical inactivity, and high blood pressure in midlife. Australians have, saying, quote, "Australians have come to understand that many cases of cancer and heart disease are preventable." Slevin also said, quote, "We now need a similar shift in thinking on dementia to focus more on prevention." Advocates are calling for the federal government to fund a national brain health campaign and embedded dementia prevention into the country's broader preventative health strategy, warning that without urgent action, the growing burden will place an increasing strain on Australia's health system.
Also in the news this week, data released by the Australia Institute that governments across the continent gave $16.3 billion in subsidies to fossil fuel companies and users in 2025. When split across each day, that amount equates to $31,020 for every day in 2025, or $590 for each person in so-called Australia. The $16.3 billion amount is a 9.4% increase compared to that of the year before, and is higher than the increase to the National Disability Insurance Scheme over the same period. The report also exposes the total budgeted for fossil fuel subsidies over the longer term is some $72.7 billion, which is 14 times the balance of the Australia Disaster Ready Fund, a fund set up to address the impacts of climate change. Of the subsidies, $10.8 billion was for the federal government's fuel tax credit scheme, which reimburses companies for the tax it pays on fuel, which the Australia Institute says is the largest fossil fuel subsidy in the continent and worth over $1 billion to the coal industry every year. The Institute also forecasted that the fuel tax credit scheme could grow 19.9% by the 2028-2029 period, outpacing funding to disability support, childcare subsidies, aged care and veterans community care support.
And finally, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, IPAN, has condemned the Albanese government's decision to deploy an Australian surveillance aircraft and military personnel to the United Arab Emirates, warning the move could further entangle Australia in a broader Middle East conflict. The deployment of a Boeing E-7A Wedgetail aircraft and 85 personnel from the Australian Defence Force has been described by the government as a defensive measure aimed at protecting Australians in the region. But critics argue it's drawing Australia deeper into escalating hostilities involving the US and Israel. Retired Army Major Cameron Leckie, spokesperson for IPAN, said, quote, "The government's claim that this is a defensive measure to protect Australians in the UAE is a fallacy," end quote. "This deployment will only increase the danger to Australians in the region and entangle us further into an illegal conflict," end quote. IPAN also raised concerns about Australia's role in intelligence sharing through joint facilities such as Pine Gap and RAAF base Tyndall, which critics say could support military operations in the region. "There is no evidence that Iran has planned to produce nuclear weapons," Leckie said, adding that Iran is a signatory to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons and has supported the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which Australia has yet to ratify. The network is calling on the government to reverse the deployment, condemn civilian attacks, and pursue diplomacy instead of military escalation. Leckie said, quote, "Attacking Iran is not a path to peace or stability, but a recipe for a wider regional conflict," end quote. "We are urging the government to pursue an independent foreign policy that prioritizes international law, peace, diplomacy, and human rights." These have been the headlines for Monday, the 16th of March. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Forests are essential ecosystems, mitigating for climate breakdown, cooling the planet, and preserving the wondrous diversity of life. Yet, they are being destroyed at an alarming rate. Here in the Kulin Nations, logging continues, increasing risk of both fires and floods. The Bob Brown Foundation is calling a national day of action, the March in March for Forests. In NAM, join us on Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m. in Parliament Gardens to demand the protection for native forests. Go to marchforforests.org for all the details, including how to volunteer. March for Forests, Sunday, the 22nd of March at 11 a.m.
A 3CR supporter.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Where history's queer futures is an audio journey into the
Trans
stories.
Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 855 AM. Before that little station ID, you heard Birthday Funeral by Nam-based band Daisy Picker. They're great. Love them. Okay, so the first segment we're going to play, following International Women's Day from last Friday, we're going to bring you an interview I helped record over the weekend where Rosie Ganino interviewed Alva Geeky. Alva Geeky is a 90-year-old feminist activist and was one of the first four women who started the women's lib movement in the 70s here in Nam. She tells us about the early days of the movement, fighting for women's rights, being housemates with Zelda Diaprano, and so much more. We'll be playing you the first half of this interview today and bring you the second half next week. Stay tuned.
Hi, Alva. Thanks so much for coming on the show and agreeing to talk to me. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you've got to say. Let's start with how you first became actively involved in the feminist movement and what was the impetus for your involvement?
Well, what happened was Zelda Prano, who I didn't know at the time, changed herself to the Commonwealth Building in Melbourne about halfway through October in 69. And she was protesting at the equal pay case in 1969 that came to the arbitration court. And by that ruling, only about 18 to 20% of women would have got equal pay. And I saw her photo in the paper and I thought, well, this is not right. You know, I was teaching at the time and we were just about to get equal pay by 71. And it was being phased in. And so I thought, well, this is disgraceful that, you know, all these women, 80% of women are not going to get equal pay. So I thought, okay, I'll ring up Zelda and I'll see how we go and maybe we can do something together. So I rang her up and then we met and we decided that we would do a similar thing at the arbitration court building at the end of October. And my flatmate, my housemate, Selma Solomon, decided that she would join us as well. So that was the end of October 79. And after that, I met Zelda a few times and then we just chatted about women in particular and we decided that really an organisation was needed to try and do something about all of the discrimination that women suffered at the time. You wouldn't, you know, I mean, people today have got no idea what it was like for women in the 70s, 60s and 70s. So anyway, we decided that we would start an organisation after the holidays. And I could talk about the ASIO listening to Zelda and my conversation in January, but I don't know whether you want to hear that or not.
Actually, that sounds really interesting. I think we'd love to hear about that.
Okay, well, Zelda was in the Communist Party at the time, and because my brother had been in it for a while, I wasn't frightened of the Communist Party. I didn't want to join, but, you know, I'd heard about it. It didn't worry me. So because she was in the Communist Party, she knew her phone was tapped. And so she said, now, I know my phone will be tapped. And she said, when we hear the click, I'll talk about my abortions. And so she used to, and she used to go into great detail because she'd had two or three abortions, illegally, of course, at that time. And then, so she'd talk about that, I'd be quiet, and then we'd hear the click and they'd clicked off because they couldn't stand to listen any longer. And then we would continue on with our conversation. And so we met, we sort of talked over January and February several times, really to buck ourselves up and talked about what we were going to do in this organisation. So in March, I think it was the 2nd, we met we advertised a little, and we met at Belmer and my place in Carlton, and 14 women turned up. And one of those women was Bon Hull, and she was really interested. She was the main one who was interested. It was really funny because some people left early because we were too political. Some women left because we weren't political enough. And some people left because we didn't hate men. So it was really, it was quite funny. So anyway, there were 14 came to the first meeting. And then after that, Bon talked to us and said, well, look, she would have the next meeting at her place. And so, because she was really enthusiastic. And so we had it at her place, and she advertised, she thought there would be, the hordes would come. So she hired 100 chairs and only 12 people turned up. But that was our second meeting. So from then on, we sort of met every 2 weeks or so for a couple of years and organised all sorts of things. We averaged about 10 people at our meetings. We had about 20 or 30 on the books, but some would come a little while and disappear and come back in the women's movement when it got going later on, and some we never saw again. So, yes, it was the sort of, we were the four mainstays, or, you know, the four amigos, or whatever you like to call us.
That's incredible, being the initiators of such an important thing like that hadn't been done before, well, not that century. That's pretty impressive. Just wondering, how did your family react?
Well, as I said before, my brother had been in the Communist Party for a little while, and I'd listened to what he had to say when I was younger, and I thought, oh, well, it sounds okay, you know. And my mother was somewhere left of the ALP, and my father, he said he was a socialist. And so we didn't talk about it a lot, but I guess I'd gleaned a lot from that. And grew up, you know, by the time I was 14 or so, I knew that I was some sort of waffly socialist, and I was, what else was I? Well, I was sort of a feminist, definitely. And so, you know, it was sort of natural for me to sort of be interested in organising something with Zelda, because she was very enthusiastic, of course, and so was Bon and Thelma.
So
I were, yeah.
Given that your family was already, well, some of them were socialists, communists, sounds like they were all communists, including your brother.
Oh, no. My mother
She
was more left of centre, more left of the ALP. My father was definitely a socialist. My other brother was right wing.
Oh, wow.
And then the one brother had been in the Communist Party for a while, but I don't know that he was in it for a long time, but he was in it for a while, I know.
Was he supportive? You
know, well, no, not exactly. He said to my mother once, oh, you know, Alva's not going to get anywhere doing all those demonstrations and things that she does. And I said to Mum, well, I don't care what he thinks, really.
What did you actually really say to your mum?
Oh, no, I don't think I'll use that word, but you can imagine what it was. I was quite annoyed, actually.
I'll bet you were. So interesting that, so the Communist Party in general obviously weren't terribly supportive of women's equality or women's rights.
No, they weren't. And neither were none of the other left-wing. See, there were lots, you probably know, but at that time, there were several left-wing groups, and they would pop up at different times, and then they split the next month because they all argued about their theory.
Yeah.
You know, there was a sort of Trotskyist group, and there was a Marxist group, there was a Leninist group, there was a Communist Party, there was the New Left.
Yeah.
And so there were all these people arguing among each other, and they kept on splitting and splitting and splitting, then they joined another group, you know, it was crazy. And so eventually, of course, those women got sick of being in those groups, and a lot of them did, and realised they were being second-class citizens within the left wing instead of it all being equal. It wasn't, you know, a fairer society for them, because they were making the tea and making the men happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say there's a saying that, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard it, if the left organise a firing squad, they form a circle. Sounds like the left was a little bit like that. But I was just wondering, in the women's movement, was that a bit different? I'd sort of like to think that women are better at working together towards a common goal. Do you think that was the case with the women's movement?
Definitely. Yeah. There were many, let's say, arguments, discussions. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen at in 1972, we organised between a few groups by then, and we organised the Women's Centre in Little Latrobe Street. And we would have a meeting, say, every 2 weeks. And a lot of the women came in from various left-wing groups, as I said, but many of us didn't. Mm-hmm. And I didn't belong to a group. And a lot of the women had come in via consciousness-raising groups, which I can talk about later. And they were really not particularly political. So the left-wing people came in with a theory, you know, that had been handed down, whatever the theory was, and they would try and espouse that and say things like, well, we'll never get women's liberation until we get a revolution. But I wasn't prepared to wait for that. It seemed to me there wasn't going to be a revolution for at least the next 50 years, which is already up, and, of course, there's nowhere near a revolution in Australia. So most of us thought, well, let's just get on with what we do agree with.
Yep.
And so, as I said, by 1975, there were all these action groups, or all the CR groups, and thousands took part in our demonstrations sometimes, you know.
3CR. If you've just tuned in, we're bringing you an interview with Alva Geeky, one of the significant activists in the early days of the women's lib movement from the 70s here in Nam. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR. Stay tuned.
I watched the film documentary Brazen Hussies on your recommendation, which I highly recommend. Especially to young people who maybe have not heard so much about the women's liberation movement. Mm-hmm. I found it really informative and really interesting. And one of the things that really struck me was how it showed the awakening of young women to the idea that things didn't have to be and shouldn't remain the way they were. And you mentioned consciousness raising groups.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit more about that and how they did help to raise awareness?
Yes, well, they sort of sprung up at the same time as the general groups got going around. See, in the beginning, in the 70s, WAC started, Women's Action Committee. But at the same time, which we didn't know, there'd also been a group started at Melbourne Uni, and I think there was one in Carlton grew up that year too early on. And they were theoretical. So they were sitting down, they were really consciousness-raising groups. Now, how the idea spread to the suburbs, I really don't know, but it did. And so, you know, there was one at Box Hill. Now, that in the 1970s, that was an outlander community. It was hardly part of Melbourne at all. I mean, now it's probably an inner suburb, but at that time it wasn't. And so there were groups all over Melbourne, and they were consciousness raising, and they started off as discussion groups. And so they discussed things like, most of them realised there was something wrong with women's lives. Most of them realised that there was something wrong with women's lives and they wanted to change it. So they discussed things like, why were they feeling that way? What could they do to change anything? What would help them stop feeling that way? I remember one lady said to me, she had a good husband, but she felt tied to the kitchen all the time. She just couldn't, you know, whatever she did, she just couldn't get away. And I think a lot of women felt that way because, you know, once you have two or three children and a husband, then that's what was expected of you. You stayed home and you did all the housework and the child rearing and you didn't go out to work. So they talked about, they mostly wanted a wider society. They wanted an in to the rest of society. They just didn't want to be home all the time, considered as second class citizens, considered only intelligent enough to well, run after the kids, etc. and they wanted more. And so they went through all of that. It took, some of them lasted 2 or 3 years in the consciousness raising groups, but at the same time, most of them started coming into the action groups as well and the demonstrations.
It sounds like while the left will wait, the left in general, I presume mainly the men who I guess were the leaders in the left movement, while they were waiting for a revolution, sounds like you women were creating your own revolution straight away, and it sounds like it worked a treat. So,
well, it is. Yeah, well, what I always say is that the Women's Liberation Movement was one of the most important social movements of the 20th century. Unfortunately, today, many people don't know anything about it or very little.
Mm.
They know about the suffragettes, but they really don't know about the women's movement in the 1970s, 80s and 90s. And it really needs to get out there more.
Mm. Yeah, and you've been certainly helping with that, your archive of all your writing, and I noticed it said jewellery as well is in the State Library archives. What, can you tell us a bit about what's in the archives?
Oh, well, my archives, a few of Zelda's and all of mine are at the State Library of Victoria. They're in the archives, and you can order them to go and see them and read them. You can't take them out. But there are a lot of them, and I had collected them when I was in Melbourne because I had intended writing a bit of a history, but it never got done. I interviewed about 12 women, and then I collected all the leaflets that I could find, the pamphlets, buttons, you know, and posters and all sorts of things. So I had all those, and I brought them with me when I moved to northern New South Wales, fortunately. And then I started writing it again later on.
So when the jewellery that's mentioned, are they the buttons that
I think they'd be the buttons. Right, okay. I think the only other jewellery would be, I put into the library, there's also some of my stuff at Melbourne University. Most of the women have put their archives into the Melbourne University archives.
Right.
But unfortunately, at the time I wanted to do that, I didn't get a reply when I wrote to see if they wanted them. So mine ended up in the library. So there's two lots. Most of them are in the Melbourne University. The only jewellery I can think of was there were several badges made with the symbol, with the women, fist of the women and the women's symbol.
Yep.
You know the one I'm talking about.
Yes, absolutely.
And yeah, so that's the only one. I had a very nice one. In fact, I still think I've got one. And they were about 5 centimetres across.
Yep.
And they were enamel and they had the symbol in the middle.
Right.
But apart from that, most of them were buttons like pro-abortion, pro-childcare.
Yep.
All those, equal pay, all those things.
Yep. We kind of still need all of those, actually.
Perhaps yeah, we well, there are lots.
A reprint of them all.
Yeah, I took them down there too.
Great. Right. So getting back to, you know, the women's liberation revolution,
mm-hmm.
when Gough Whitlam was elected in 1972, did it bring great hope to you all, especially with the appointment the following year of Elizabeth Reid as advisor on the welfare of women and children, which was a world first?
Yes, it was a world first. Look, as far as I could understand at the time, we didn't take terribly much notice of Gough because, I mean, people would have been pleased that he was in rather than the Liberal Party who did nothing for women. We didn't take a lot of notice because we were too busy doing what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't think that government would do very much. But, of course, gradually Gough did. And actually, when you read the things that Gough talked about and did, he really understood what we were on about. He really understood that women wanted to acknowledge for other things rather than being mothers and housewives.
Mm.
And therefore he appointed Elizabeth Reid, and I'm sure she must have educated him a lot.
Mm.
And we didn't take much notice of Elizabeth either, because there was a term that was used in the women's movement at the time called femocrat. Yep. I don't know if you've heard that. It was almost a derogatory term.
Right.
And it was meant to explain women who went into the usual political parties, etc., and tried to change things through that.
Yep.
And a lot of women in the movement were very hard line, and they just dismissed them.
Right.
Whereas I was always thinking, well, look, she might not be able to do any good, but she might.
Right.
So I'm not going to say anything. And of course, when she got demoted, as she did, then a lot of women, of course, were very sad, because they started to realise that it was better to have someone in the powers of be than not have anybody at all.
Mm.
You know?
Do you feel she got a lot of support while she was in?
I'm not sure. I from what I've read, she might have got more support from the Canberra people, the women's liberation there, and maybe even the Sydney people. But I've read things from the Melbourne people who really were critical of her situation, you know, that position, not her in particular, not her as a person, but that position.
Yep.
But then, of course, when she got demoted, then we all said, oh, what a dreadful thing to happen.
Mm.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here on 3CR. That was the first half of the interview with Elva Geeky, speaking on the feminist women's lib movement back in the 70s. We'll be bringing you the second half of that interview next week. Next up, we're going to bring you the second episode of our monthly segment called Wing Beats Per Minute, where Michael and Jared delve into an insect's importance within ecosystems. This month's segment is about butterflies. Stay tuned.
Insects and music, you can't refuse it. It's time to choose it before we lose it. 90 boom at 120 hash. Wing beats per minute happen so fast.
Wing beats per minute. Wing beats per minute.
Mate, we're back. Wing Beats Per Minute is the show. And today we're talking about mistletoe's link with butterflies and the system. And as always, the show ain't strictly about insects, but also the natural systems and relationships they are involved in or is around them.
Yes, indeed. One of the things we're going to be looking at today is butterflies, which is an insect which most people will love, I think. So I thought, just to kick it off, we will talk about the life cycle of the butterfly, just so everyone understands that. It's a bit of a chicken and an egg thing, really. But first of all, there has to be an adult butterfly, doesn't there, to lay eggs. The eggs are laid on plants that the larvae, which is the caterpillars, will eat. So that can be anything from grass to leaves of trees to all sorts of things, really. But generally, it's plants. And so the eggs are laid on the plants. They emerge from that as larvae or caterpillars. They eat and eat and eat and eat, like the storybook, and then they go into their chrysalis and pupae. And from that point, which is a bit magical, isn't it, really, then they turn into the adult butterfly and flap around and do their thing, where they then again, they match up, meet up and lay eggs again. Mm. And it keeps going and going, hopefully forever. But we're going to look at one specific butterfly, which is the Imperial Jezebel. And it has a connection to mistletoe. And, let's have a look at the mistletoes.
So the mistletoe plant is hemiparasitic, which means it's partly parasitic. So in eucalyptus and acacia species in Melbourne, mistletoe taps into the xylem part of its host. So that's the plumbing part of the tree with a tendril. And then that tendril protrudes into the host. So in trees, it takes the H2O from the host plant while performing its own photosynthesis with the leaves. So it's not entirely reliable, relying on the tree, but it also gathers nutrients itself.
Yeah, so it's not 100% parasitic at all.
No, but I mean, it needs the tree to be able to grow, but it does gather its own nutrients itself. So due to having red tubular flowers, the most visitation the mistletoe flower gets is from a bird. So they do, birds I should say, they do most of the pollinating, but not exclusively. And in Melbourne, a range of honey-eater birds perform this pollination task, and we'll go into what some of these birds are a bit later on. So once it's pollinated, it then produces berries. It's mostly mistletoe birds, but some other honey eaters eat the berries. But to my knowledge, it's only mistletoe birds in Melbourne that then wipe their scat on the tree.
Yeah.
And within that scat, they have the seed of the berry. And then from that point, that's when the seed starts growing its tendrils and then tapping into the tree to get the HTO.
The mistletoe bird has to do a poop on the branch, and that's how it starts.
And it wipes it off.
Wipes it off.
Now, there's a lot to unpack there, mate, from a system's point of view. So how does mistletoe benefit the system? Well, because mistletoe specimens tap into trees to get to the xylem, they're accessing the HTO from its host, and then the mistletoe can flower at different times of the year.
So it's not a set time.
Well, when some times of the year when there's not a lot of moisture available, if mistletoe can get the moisture, then it can be growing in the height of summer, for instance.
When it's really dry.
When it's really dry, which has some amazing benefits for the system. So moisture is not a limiting factor for mistletoe, and that becomes particularly important for forest systems. So as I was saying, in summer when most plants are struggling to access water, which they need to produce carbohydrates, CO2, cool down and the likes, mistletoe specimens can be thriving and providing a lot of flowers. And this so happens to be amazing for some insects, like the Jezebel butterflies you were mentioning before, because they are a butterfly that flies and is very active as an adult and as a caterpillar in summer.
Yeah, that's right. The Jezebel butterfly lays its eggs on the leaves of the mistletoe. And so from that point, they emerge and the caterpillars eat the leaves voraciously, I'd imagine, and they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then they form into the chrysalis, and then they emerge as adult butterflies. So if you want to see the Jezebel butterfly, you need to be in a place where there's mistletoe for starters, which is generally in forests. You need trees, eucalyptus trees, 100%. So you need to be looking up towards the canopy to be seeing these butterflies. Mm. That was something we were going to talk about, like the ecology and life cycles that is up in the canopy that you don't always see. Like often people might think that butterflies are low on the ground and they're going to the flowers on the ground, but there's a whole strata up in the forest that is occupied by many different insects.
Mm. And perhaps only for part of their life cycle. When you think of the moonlight jewel, when I was seeing it, I was seeing it around that sort of mid-story level.
Yeah.
Like on prickly Moses and some plants where it lays its eggs.
Wattle trees.
But after speaking to a friend of ours called Warren, Warren Thomason, he was noticing the moonlight jewel feeding up in the eucalyptus trees.
On the flowers.
On the flowers. So, animals can spend different parts of their life, depending on where they are in their life cycle, at different structured layers in the forest. And knowing where they're going to be for a particular part of their life cycle makes it easier to find these animals. So if you know where to look, you can go and see this beauty. So a little bit of research, perhaps a little bit of listening to this show, can help you find these things. When you see them, geez. Jezebel butterflies, what about the colours, mate?
Well, we should describe them because they are very beautiful butterfly. on the underside of their wings, which is what we see because we're looking up from the ground, they've got a beautiful black, white, red and yellow patterning, which is it's quite stunning. It's very eye-catching. And interesting, above on the top part of the wings, it's very dull. It's like black and white.
So
you can see that you can see the color from underneath, but from the top it would be wouldn't be seen very much, which would help for predators like birds.
So
and
when they've got all those colors and they want to attract a mate, well, they're showing the underside, aren't they? But for the when they've got that top show, they're basically trying to be hidden. Because, you know, as an insect and most animals, sometimes you want to be seen, you want to attract a mate, but sometimes you just want to be not seen because you're hiding out and you're feeding and you're pretty volatile to being predated on when you're feeding as well, because your mind's not on the game of what's around you. You might be focused on nectar and that sweet nectar, sipping that up. That's good times.
The Jezebels also have another part of their life cycle that helps with predation as well. When the larvae are feeding on the mistletoe leaves, they are ingesting chemicals from the leaves, which then imbues them as adults to be unpalatable to birds and also maybe potentially poisonous. So that's another element to mistletoes.
Absolutely. Great point.
Yeah.
Now, if we branch out and discuss the wider ecosystem around mistletoe, often you see insectivore birds and they're hanging out within the mistletoe inflorescence in a tree, and they're not feeding on the flowers. They don't have a beak capable of getting into these tubular flowers, but they're there because of the insects. So they can go there and pick them off. Now, one of the things I've learned in the last year or so is when the mistletoe leaves actually drop, they're so nutritious because they're putting all their energy into photosynthesizing to make CO2 because they're getting water from the plant. When they drop, they're actually really nutritious for insects on the ground. And then birds that can feed on the ground, like your yellow rump thornbill, and not all birds will feel comfortable doing that in the open, but the yellow rump thornbill is one of the thornbill species that will do that. I mean, there's just lots of insects they can get into there. So there's a big wide story around mistletoe.
It's a big wide story indeed. I'm just thinking there, like we've been talking about up in the canopy, but when the leaves drop, that's down on the forest floor. So that's gone from the canopy down to the floor, down to the forest floor, and a whole new array of insects and interactions happen from the mistletoe.
Absolutely. And then also it's the cover. So if you're thinking, I mean, Melbourne gets so hot in certain times. If you can make a nest amongst that inflorescence, you've got more cover from shade and you're potentially less likely to be seen from a predator. So some honey eaters and the mistletoe bird from time to time will actually make their nest in there because they're more protected. And just taking that a step further, I was listening to a talk on mistletoe, and this this doctor who knows a lot about mistletoe was saying that you can even record lizards on the ground underneath the mistletoe because they're getting more shade from time to time, which is pretty amazing. And, you know, going back to mistletoe and taking moisture from the xylem, the other day when we were in Peter Frankie Reserve, with the mistletoe flowering en masse, within 5 minutes we'd encountered three honey eaters.
Yeah.
So we had the eastern spine bull, we had the white naped honey eater, and the yellow faced honey eater. That's within 5 minutes.
Yeah, they were loving it.
Absolutely. Just dining out, going from back and forth. It was such a spectacle. We could see that because we knew they were flowering and we were looking up. But if you're a walker, sort of dedicating your time to getting from A to B, and not stopping at certain points and looking at habitat, you could miss something like that. So having a bit of information about what's going on, I think, really helps seeing the beauty in Melbourne. And that got me thinking that I did a bit of a study a couple of years ago with some students, and mistletoe was flowering in winter.
Wintertime.
When most plants aren't flowering then.
It's flowering now at the moment. That's why we brought it up, actually. Like, it's flowering out in the forests of Nillumbik at the moment.
Go and see it. And then I look back at that report, and there were five species of honey eater, and we compared that to eucalyptus flowers. All five of those honey owners were almost exclusively going to the mistletoe. So they weren't feeding on the eucalyptus, and that's because they weren't really flowering.
Right.
En masse, anyway. You can generally, if you look up at eucalypt, see one or two flowers and specimens flowering, but the majority of the nectar was with the mistletoe.
Yeah, it's interesting with the eucalypts flowering because sometimes they'll flower en masse, and sometimes you might think that that's from a stress sort of point of view, as in they're thinking they need to make seed, but often it will just be individual trees flowering through the forest, not en masse.
Absolutely, yeah. So a lot of people don't, they've got this thing about mistletoe, and it goes back to decades ago where there was this theory that if you had too much mistletoe on one particular specimen, then it could be the undoing of the tree, then suddenly the tree passes away. But if you actually look at the ecology and the wider abiotic conditions, there's a lot more going on, isn't there?
There really is. I think really the mistletoe, when there's lots and lots of mistletoe on a tree and it looks sick, I think it's more of a symptom rather than the cause.
Absolutely.
Like sometimes you'll see large eucalypts in paddocks where they're just by themselves and they're loaded with mistletoe and they're not healthy. But it's not necessarily because of the mistletoe. It's because of the conditions. They might not have enough water. They're open to the wind, so they're drying out more, and they're basically stressed.
Yeah, and whilst, you know, and it's not the mistletoe's fault, it's almost like that's a bit of a tipping point, would you say?
I think that it's potential that the trees, when they're healthy, they are more likely, they can cope and they may possibly maybe repel as well some of the mistletoe.
Yeah, yeah. And if you take mistletoe out of the environment, you don't get all these wonderful things that we're talking about. Now, beautiful Jezebels.
Yeah.
You might not get the bird song because if the birds don't have those nutritious things to feed on, if they don't have that beautiful spot, you know, to have their nest and raise their young. And we're big on next gen. It's all very well to have a beautiful bird in 1 year, but you want these birds to be there year and year again so your family can see it. It's a family thing.
It's a family affair, isn't it?
That's right.
But that's a really good point about the next generation, because without the conditions, there won't be the next generation of butterflies or other insects. But yeah. I think particularly with butterflies, if the habitat for them is not there anymore, they won't be the next generation. And we've been looking at mistletoes, but butterflies often lay their eggs on grass or on shrubs and small trees close to the ground.
Mate, I'm feeling a call to action here.
Oh, a call to action.
That's what I'm feeling, mate. Keep going.
Well, I would like to put it out there that when you're doing gardening at your house, that you have a look at what's going on. Like if you're seeing butterflies and things like that, like a lot of people might have seen the really small blue ones, the common grass blue, and also like the common browns, they lay their eggs on grass. So if you're mowing the grass constantly and it's at a very small level, there will never be any butterfly generations from your lawn.
Yeah.
But if you leave some of it or even all of it, you will be promoting the next generation.
Absolutely. Just take that. I mean, just have a go. Like have a corner pocket where it, and it's a perception and a paradigm thing. Like a lot of people think, oh, it's got to be neat and tidy, but not exclusively throughout your yard. Leave a little bit.
Yeah, look, there has to be utility in your backyard. And also at the moment we have fire risk concerns. Yep. So, you know, there needs to be utility to the backyard. Yeah. Like snakes are another issue. But I think we don't need to homogenize our backyards just to appease our own aesthetic.
Yeah. Mate.
Yeah.
So mistletoe, love it.
Yes, indeed. Okay, this brings us up to the song that we're going to play with a tenuous link to the topic. And this is quite a tenuous link. This is a group called High Dependency Unit out of Dunedin, originally on the legendary Flying Nun record label. The link is at the end of the song that they sing, "We All Need the Next World," which is what the butterflies and insects need. So take it away.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM on the dial. That song was called Babaya by the High Dependency Unit from Aotearoa. And before that, you heard the second iteration of our new regular segment here on the Monday Breakfast Show called Wing Beats Per Minute, brought to you by Michael and Jared this week. This month, they were talking about butterflies within their larger theme of the importance of insects within ecosystems. We're now going to listen to an interview that James McKenzie from In Your Face did with comedian Cassie Workman about their show, which will be playing at the Melbourne International Comedy Fest, called You Are Here, as well as Cassie's experiences as a trans person living under the Trump regime. You can catch Cassie's show at the Melbourne International Comedy Fest from the 25th of March to the 14th of April.
You are doing an allergy to the New Jersey West Valley Mall. That is incredible. Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, it's a fictional mall. So I lived in New Jersey for a while. I lived in Asbury Park in New Jersey, which is on the Jersey Shore. It's a beautiful little town. It's very much like the town in Bob's Burgers. I don't know if you've ever seen it. And I fell in love with it, and I fell in love with Jersey. But I wanted to make a show about the death of capitalism. And I thought, you know, what better analogy than a mall?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they're kind of like a symbol of everything that's wrong with capitalism, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. So that was very convenient for me.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. So tell us a little bit more about it. What can people expect on stage?
Well, it's visually, I think it's a very cool show. There's a lot going on. There's a big set that I'm very proud of, and there's a lot of music and a lot of silliness, but also some commentary and a fantasy story that sort of goes along with it.
Wow! Tell us more about the fantasy story.
Well, the show sort of centers around this character called Siervo, who is the son of Mexican immigrants, and on his way to their weekend job, they get stopped by ICE, and his parents are abducted, and then he runs to the nearest building to hide, which just happens to be the now abandoned West Valley Mall. And the mall is sentient and wants to basically feed off his energy. So it starts to make him forget things, who he is, his memories, and it leads him further and further into this trap at the center of the mall. So it's about his journey through some of the, you know, the archetypes of capitalism and how capitalism necessarily disintegrates into fascism, and his struggle with that. And inside the mall, he meets a stag who is sort of a guide for him. Did I mention it's a comedy?
Wow. I mean, what a gift you must have to be able to make a comedy out of things that are so timely. I mean, we've all watched with horror how we've seen the dystopian kind of, you know, scenarios just unfolding in Minneapolis with ICE.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, as I say, I've spent the last 2 years in the U.S. I was living in New York and New Jersey and for a little bit in Chicago. And part of this show was inspired by coming home to my house in New Jersey and having to basically run because I saw that ICE was, you know, out the side of my house pulling people out of their cars.
Wow. So you really saw the racism of that and the fear of that and the intimidation of that. And you must have been terrified.
Yeah. I mean, it is terrifying. And I think people have every right to be terrified, but it's also, it's also enraging.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when you see people being shot, when you see, you know, just the kind of like the, it's almost like the hands are around America's throat right now, you know, especially in sanctuary cities like Chicago, you know, the hands of authoritarianism just, you know, creeping closer and closer to, you know, grasping people by the neck.
You know, that I think is inevitable. That was baked into the American experiment from the beginning. And now as it as things deteriorate, it's just becoming more obvious.
So it must be quite cathartic for you to have a little bit of distance from the US and to be able to perform this show in Australia.
I wouldn't describe it as cathartic. There's very few positives to be taken from this. I left because I feared for my safety as a trans person, and I was like, well, you know, it's just a matter of time before we end up in a camp if we stay here. So I had to get out. But what I wanted to do was create something that could talk about that slightly removed in a way that was sort of more emotional than cerebral. Because in my career I've made a lot of fables, I make fables, and this is sort of along those lines, but.
The experience of being a trans person in the US and seeing the attacks against trans people must have been enraging, must have been terrifying. Can you tell us a bit more about your experiences over there in that regard?
Without going into detail, it's frightening. There were moments where I had a genuine worry for my safety, under threat of violence. But we're a tenacious people, the trans people. You can't get rid of us. We'll be around.
In the US, did you have a real sense of the vigilantes, not just ICE, but, you know, we saw the vigilantes policing queer events like Drag Storytime, for example. Did you get a sense of that over there? Did you see stuff like that, apart from ICE, just vigilantes doing that kind of stuff?
Yes. I lived above New Jersey's oldest gay bar. It's called Georgie's Bar. I used to live in the apartment just above that, so I was at Georgie's Bar all the time. And there was a guy who used to park out the side of Georgie's Bar and just leave his MAGA hat on the dashboard so that you couldn't get into Georgie's Bar without walking past this guy's big honking truck and his MAGA hat on the dashboard. And there were times when, you know, ICE would drive by slowly and just check things out, and there were always, like, MAGA guys around. They could be very bold
and very unhinged as well. I mean, their bar is quite low for who they accept in ICE, right?
It is extremely for an organization with so much power and so much money. You would expect a little more discernment from the people who choose who gets in. But it's a winning strategy for Trump. He's made all of his decisions based on his gut and seemingly whatever the worst possible thing is he could possibly do. That's what he does. So it makes a lot of sense to me that would be the case.
What do you see as the end game of all this? I mean, it seems like, you know, we're going to have ICE patrolling voting booths in cities like New York and Chicago during the midterms. Do you think that will happen? And what do you think the end game of all this is?
Yeah, I think that'll definitely happen in some places. It seems to me that, I mean, a lot of people say, you know, what is the point of this? If you get rid of all of the people that you don't like and there's nobody left to buy your products and participate in your system, then how do you maintain your obscene wealth? You know, what is the selling point for these billionaires and oligarchs? You know, but I sincerely don't believe that they feel like they need human beings anymore. I think probably they're going to create a system where it's just them and AI and some robots, and they don't really need us anymore. So this could turn out to be like a very devastating and catastrophic path to go down for the human race.
Absolutely. And you look at the links between the Trump administration and, you know, the oligarchs of AI and big tech, and it's not a dystopian movie anymore, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you feel crazy for saying it, but I mean, it's right there. It's easily demonstrable. But it sounds like something from a sci-fi movie.
Absolutely. And, you know, the scenes in Minneapolis with people, like, you know, surrounding the ice cars and people holding up their phones and filming it and the snow and just everything, the whole kind of, you know, visual of it all does seem like a film. It really does. It's crazy, but it's the reality that we're living in.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, You Are Here is happening for the Melbourne Comedy Festival, 26th of March to the 19th of April at Melbourne Town Hall in the backstage room. And you will also be performing at the Brisbane and Sydney Comedy Festivals. Cassie Workman, it has been a real pleasure to chat with you today on 3CR. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thanks.
You went and made me mad. I'm about to crash. Machete on the dash. Pedal to the metal and I take off in a flash. This is Black Britney season. Real got the bitch, I got the proper seasoning. Filthy mouth that need a proper cleaning. If a gobble got a problem in the dirt's where I leave them. Some of you Johnnies ain't impressing me. Aren't you curry sausages, please? You stole the recipe. Mispronounced the word, they saying deadly. Why was Johnny shit really be stressing me? You see my face? Screen and I'm up in the magazines. I saw my name on your Mr. Tits. She get the licking when I hit the split. I go up ties. And I got family on both sides. I go up ties. And I'm stepping on these white lies. I go up ties. And I got family on both sides. I go up ties. Deadly bitch till the day I die. I be pressing his, rubbing on my body and my breast assist. Ain't leave no witnesses. I thought I told you that a tater handles business, sis. I bust the window out, I leave them bricks. King's curry licking all of my tits. Monkey brain in my lips. This ain't a thong, it's a G-string bitch. Doing splits, looking back on the dick. Banana rubbing my clit. Now I'ma put you all to shame. Miss Canina, they remember the name. Straight shit on the aim. One song but the fame, I'm still a Tassie girl, I ain't a fucking damn thing changed, huh? You Johnnies ain't really black, and now I sister gotta hit you with the facts. DNA that you lack, you ain't know how to act. I ain't your fucking titter bitch and I'm as black as my crack. Yeah, I ain't afraid to take it there. You clearly unaware, I'ma run them up and put my lead up in the air. Yeah, brush your ochre through my hair. Now these crackers out here really looking scared. Pen so hard I get my certificate. Dyslexic I am for the benefit. Mug too fug, I had to go celibate. I'ma go crazy just for the hell of it. You see my face on the TV screen, and I'm up in the magazines. I saw my name on your Mr. Tits. She get the licking when I hit the split. I go up ties. And I got family on both sides. I go up ties. Taking a piss, say they're moving money, but they ain't taking shit. They ain't about it, nah. They're never there for the people. Love to love my culture, but don't see us as equals. I'm talking real white trash, 360 to fast. Pops so many pills, he turned his bread into mash. I whip the bitch, call him Matthew. Face look like a cashew. Love to run their mouth, but always scared to get at you. Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. Fuck you when you're something, cross the older Aussie boy. Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. When you're southern, cross the older Aussie boys. I got mob ties. And I got family on both sides. I got mob ties. And I'm stepping on these white lies. I got mob ties. And I got family on both sides. I got mob ties. Deadly bitch till the day I die.
That track was Mob Ties by Miss Canina. Sorry about the couple swears, but it's a banger. Before that, we were listening to a interview that was on the show In Your Face, where James McKenzie spoke to trans comedian Cassie Workman about their show You Are Here as well, as their experiences living as a trans person under the Trump regime. You can catch Cassie's show at the Melbourne International Comedy Show from the 25th of March to the 14th of April.
And I was just looking at Cassie's show and, Cassie was the winner of the Fringe First Award at the 2022 Edinburgh Fringe. And the director Phoebe Waller-Bridge described You Are Here as, reviewed it as captivated from start to finish.
Wow.
Yeah, so really cool.
I'd love to go see it.
So you can see them between the 25th of March and the 14th of April, as we said. It is 26 minutes past 8 on the 16th of March. We've only got a few minutes left of the show, so we'll just remind you listeners what we've had on today's show. We started the show with an interview that Hannah helped record, in which Rosie Giannino interviewed Alva Geeky, who is a 90-year-old feminist activist and was one of the first four women who started the women's liberation movement in the 70s here in Nam. And that conversation, the first half of that conversation was talking about the early days of the movement, fighting for women's rights, and a little bit about being housemates with the iconic Zelda DiaPrano. As Hannah said earlier in the show, we'll be bringing you the second half of that interview next week. Mm-hmm. Following that, we heard the second iteration of our new monthly, regular monthly segment called Wing Beats Per Minute, focusing on the importance of insects within ecosystems. This month, Michael and Jared spoke about the importance of butterflies. And yeah, as Hannah just said, the show ended with a conversation that James McKenzie did with Cassie Workman about their show You Are Here. And we'll put the link to find Cassie's show in the show notes for the podcast that we publish. So I guess with that, we're out of here.
Yeah.
We'll see you next week.
Have a lovely week.
Stay out of the rain.
Lovely listeners. Stay dry.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.